Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I am Alex Sagan, and I'm ready to guide us through another stack of fantastic, really eye-opening research this week.
And I'm Sam Fleming, here to help unpack the implications, synthesize the data, and, you know, connect some of those global dots.
So this week, we are plunging into quite an exhaustive exploration, really, of the essential international science and technology news.
That's right, from the New Scientist magazine for the week of October 25th, 2025.
And our mission today feels particularly crucial because, well, this week's sources capture these unique, intense pressure points of our current era, don't they?
They really do. We're aiming to cut through the noise, extract the most crucial insights for you.
And focusing especially on this tension between individual, sometimes quite radical action, you know, think rogue billionaires, tech hubris.
And the need for collective global systems, whether that's governing the atmosphere or understanding consciousness, or even what happens when this massive AI bubble finally bursts.
It's a deep dive that truly covers the spectrum. So to kick us off, we really have to start with the biggest shared resource we possess.
Our planet's climate. Absolutely. And this week's leader section tackles a problem that, well, it demands collective action, but it's increasingly susceptible to private wealth, individual influence.
Yeah, the governance of the atmosphere. Let's unpack the core argument presented right away.
Okay, so basically, climate change is inherently a collectivist endeavor, right? We share one atmosphere.
What one person does, what one nation does, affects everyone else. Simple as that.
And yet the data shows responsibility and influence are anything but equally distributed.
The sources highlight a truly staggering statistic, don't they?
They do. The wealthiest 1% of the global population,
yeah,
responsible for 1/5 of all carbon emissions since 1990.
1/5! That places immense responsibility and, let's face it, capability in the hands of a tiny group.
Exactly. So if global governing bodies keep failing to implement the necessary deep emissions cuts,
the logic follows. What happens when those individuals with the deepest pockets, the highest emissions, decide they need a faster solution?
And that leads directly to what the sources call, well, frankly, the nightmare scenario. The risk of rogue geoengineering.
Because currently there's nothing stopping it, is there?
Not really. No robust international agreements, no legal frameworks stopping an individual or a private group or, yeah, an ultra-wealthy billionaire from just taking action.
Unilaterally attempting planetary cooling, buying a fleet of jets, tinkering with the atmosphere, completely outside any global consensus.
And that unilateral tinkering is terrifying precisely because the consequences are so huge, potentially catastrophic.
And yet largely unknown. We could be talking about causing persistent drought in major agricultural regions.
Or unintentionally damaging the ozone layer. Fundamentally changing the world for everyone based on one actor's decision.
Which just underscores this immediate, almost desperate need for updated global governance.
Yeah, the sources argue we need comprehensive international agreements now.
Yeah.
Not just on rogue geoengineering.
But also to govern things that maybe weren't seen as major threats a decade ago, like launching satellite mega constellations.
Right, which currently operate without any kind of unified, globally restricted regime. It's a bit of a wild west up there.
So to gauge the level of anxiety among scientists, New Scientist did something quite interesting.
They commissioned an exclusive anonymous survey, 120 leading climate scientists, many of them core IPCC contributors.
Asking specifically about solar geoengineering or SRM.
And the expectations were, well, genuinely frightening. A full 2/3 of these respondents expect large-scale efforts to dim the sun.
To actually block a measurable amount of sunlight from reaching the surface before the year 2100.
And they believe this has become much more likely specifically because of the continuous, widespread global failure to cut greenhouse gas emissions effectively.
It's seen as a sort of desperate backup plan almost. And here's the critical link back to that rogue actor problem.
The survey found that 52%, over half of these top climate scientists, believe the deployment of SRM is most likely to be driven by a rogue actor.
So not through some careful UN-sanctioned process, but initiated by a private company, a single billionaire, or maybe a nation-state acting alone.
Which is incredibly risky.
Yeah.
And the shared perception of that risk is massive.
The biggest area of consensus in the whole survey, wasn't it?
Yeah, 81% agree the world desperately needs a new international treaty or convention to govern these large-scale deployment decisions.
Because they understand once one party starts geoengineering the planet, everyone lives under that new climate regime. No choice.
So let's look closer at the methods they expect might be used.
Stratospheric aerosol injection, that was the front runner, right? Releasing tiny particles high up.
Exactly. Sulfur or maybe calcium carbonate particles high in the stratosphere to reflect sunlight back into space. Favored by over 60%.
It basically mimics the natural cooling effect we see after huge volcanic eruptions.
The leading alternative is marine cloud brightening. That involves ships spraying microscopic sea salt into low-lying ocean clouds.
Making them brighter, more reflective. It's seen as less globally disruptive.
Right. And there was that small field trial already done, aiming to protect the Great Barrier Reef back in 2024.
But only 16% thought this would be the main large-scale approach. Most expect the stratospheric route.
Yeah. But regardless of the method, the chief dangers cited by the scientists are, well, extremely severe.
Let's start with termination shock. That sounds ominous.
It is. Imagine a rogue actor starts SRM, maybe runs out of money, or a war halts the deployment. The interventions suddenly stop.
And the consequence would be catastrophic, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All those greenhouse gases we've emitted are still up there. The planet, which was shielded by the aerosols, would experience decades of stored-up warming returning almost instantly.
A rapid temperature spike over just a few years. Devastating for ecosystems, agriculture, society. No time to adapt.
Then there's regional disruption. Climate models show this isn't a simple global thermostat.
Tinkering in one place can have unexpected effects elsewhere.
Exactly. Research suggests trying to cool the Indian Ocean might reverse drought in North Africa, but cause severe drought in East Africa.
And stratospheric aerosols could cut monsoon rainfall in parts of Africa by up to 20%. Think famine, conflict.
And maybe the most insidious danger is psychological, political.
The risk of reducing the motivation to actually cut carbon emissions.
Precisely. If geoengineering is seen as a functional, cheap band-aid, politicians and industries might just use it to delay the really hard, deep cuts needed to fix the root cause.
But the ultimate risk, the one most commonly cited by the experts themselves,
was the simplest. Unknown consequences. Just the sheer complexity of Earth systems.
Unintended cascading effects that even our best supercomputers can't predict. It's a huge global gamble, plain and simple.
The irony is just profound, isn't it? Trying to stabilize the climate by pumping more pollution into the atmosphere.
Yeah. Which actually brings us quite neatly to our next major global concern.
Shifting from Earth's delicate atmospheric balance right out into the orbital environment.
Where commercial activity is creating another unforeseen pollution crisis. But first, let's turn our gaze way, way up.
Far past low Earth orbit. To the Galactic Center Gamma Ray Excess, the GCE. A decade-long astrophysical mystery.
Right. This persistent signal, an unusually high concentration of gamma rays seen since 2009 coming from the center of the Milky Way.
And for years, the debate over its source was really pitched between two quite radical camps.
One possibility, an unobserved population of pulsars, those rapidly rotating neutron stars. Very hard to detect, but known to produce gamma rays.
Or two, a dark matter signature, specifically weakly interacting massive particles, WIMPs, annihilating each other in the dense galactic core.
That dark matter idea recently fell out of favor, though.
It did. WIMPs are needed theoretically for the galaxy's mass balance, but direct searches on Earth found nothing.
Plus, the GCE signal itself looked flattened, sort of like a rugby ball, which contradicted expectations.
Cosmologists thought the dark matter halo at the galactic center should be a perfect smooth sphere.
But this is where new research by Joseph Silk and colleagues changes the game.
They simulated the Milky Way's history, recognizing it didn't just pop into existence. It grew through mergers with smaller galaxies over billions of years.
And each of those mergers brought its own cloud of dark matter along for the ride.
What's fascinating is their simulations show that because of this messy history of mergers, the predicted dark matter distribution is absolutely not spherical.
All those gravitational disruptions and infalls would create a squashed, non-spherical distribution.
And the simulated squashed shape matches the observed GCE signal perfectly.
So it doesn't prove dark matter is the cause.
But it removes the major objection.
Yeah.
It puts the WIMP theory firmly back on the table.
The researchers now estimate, what, a 50% chance the signal is actually dark matter annihilation?
Yeah, potentially solving one of the universe's biggest mysteries. But we need proof.
Observational proof. Which hopefully comes from the Cherenkov Telescope Array Observatory.
That's the next generation gamma ray telescope, under construction now, due to start observing in 2026.
It should have the sensitivity and resolution to finely distinguish between faint distributed WIMP signals and point-like pulsar flashes.
Okay, so from vast cosmic scales down to, well, junk in our backyard, let's talk satellite pollution.
Yeah, the rapid onset of high-altitude pollution caused by dead satellites. This is a problem of immense and growing scale.
The numbers are just astounding. Over 15,000 active satellites currently orbiting. Starlink alone has over 8,000.
But based on current plans from Amazon, other companies, various nations, estimates predict maybe 70,000 satellites in low Earth orbit by 2030.
And the issue is, most of these are cheap, with short lifespans, maybe 5 years.
And to avoid becoming space junk, they're intentionally directed to burn up in the atmosphere, specifically the mesosphere, 50 to 80 kilometers up.
Dr. Jonathan McDowell estimates around 900 tons of space debris vaporize up there annually. The worry is the toxic cocktail this creates.
Satellites are up to 40% aluminum. When that burns up, it oxidizes into alumina oxide.
And alumina aerosols are known ozone-depleting chemicals. We saw this back in the 90s with solid rocket boosters causing small, temporary ozone holes. This isn't theoretical.
And it's not just alumina. There's also black carbon, soot, from unburned rocket fuel injected directly at high altitude.
Right, and while the amount might seem tiny compared to ground-level industrial output, its long-term effects are disproportionate.
Because the high-altitude atmosphere is less turbulent, right, so stuff stays up there longer.
Exactly. Soot released at 50, 80 kilometers can stay in circulation for years, gradually filtering down into the stratosphere where the ozone layer lives.
Modeling suggests that due to this incredibly long circulation time, high-altitude soot could be up to 500 times more warming than the exact same amount released at ground level.
The potential environmental impact is huge. Models suggest if we hit that 60,000 satellite mark.
The accumulated pollution could cause the mesosphere to warm by 1.5 degrees Celsius.
And reduce high-level southern hemisphere polar vortex winds by 10%. That's a measurable impact on fundamental atmospheric dynamics, driven entirely by commercial activity.
So mitigation is obviously key. What's being done?
Well, research is underway. Using things like plasma wind tunnels to simulate reentry burnup.
Trying to figure out if satellites turn into less harmful vapor or those dangerous oxides.
Exactly. And then using that data to optimize reentry trajectories. Should they be shallow or deep to minimize the harmful stuff?
But the real long-term solution requires a completely different approach to space engineering, doesn't it?
Absolutely. A shift away from this disposable single-use model. We need a circular economy in space.
Servicing, upgrading, refueling, recycling satellites in orbit?
Yeah, the European Space Agency is already working on demo missions for this, recognizing space is a finite resource, just like the atmosphere.
Okay, so moving from cosmic pollution and dark matter right down to the frontiers of human and ancestral biology.
The next set of discoveries in this issue really blur the lines between mind, body, and future tech.
Right, pivoting from global governance to the radical capabilities of the human body and mind. Let's talk about this paralysis breakthrough.
Yes. The one that sounds like something straight out of science fiction. Telepathic control and shared sensation between two people.
It involves a man named Keith Thomas, paralyzed from the chest down. He already had electrodes implanted in his brain's motor and sensory areas for his right hand.
Right. Part of an earlier study, he had a neural decoder, used AI to control his own hand via electrical stimulation.
But this new study took it way further. They connected him to a non-disabled woman.
She wore electrodes on her forearm, high-res force sensors on her thumb and index finger.
And while she made no effort to move, Thomas successfully opened and closed her hand just by thinking about moving his own hand, essentially outsourcing motor control.
And even more astonishingly, he could feel the sensation through her hand. The force sensor feedback was transmitted back to his brain implants.
So while blindfolded, he could distinguish between different objects. She held a baseball, a soft foam ball, a firmer ball.
With 64% accuracy, based purely on that transmitted sensory feedback.
Which raises that strange question, is that real sensation or just decoded data?
It's sort of both, isn't it?
Yeah.
His brain is interpreting the direct electrical stimulation it receives as the feeling of pressure, grip, texture in his own non-functional hand.
The immediate applications seem profoundly positive, especially for rehabilitation.
Definitely. Like, Thomas helped another paralyzed woman, Kathy DiNapoli, practice drinking from a can. He supplied the motor control, felt the grip.
And after working with him this way for months, her own grip strength nearly doubled.
The team noted it was far more engaging and beneficial than standard, kind of tedious electrical stimulation therapy.
This throws up a massive ethical dilemma, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. While the medical use is altruistic, the underlying tech hypothetically allows non-medical uses. One person remotely controlling and feeling through someone else's body.
Experts immediately raised severe ethical alarms. If you can control another person, you could cause harm, commit a crime using their body as a proxy.
It forces us to ask, where's the boundary of individual autonomy when neural interfaces allow sharing or delegating motor and sensory function? It's leaped right out of sci-fi.
From futuristic Neuralinks, let's jump back 1.5 million years to the first confirmed fossil hands of Paranthropus boisei.
Found near Lake Turkana in Kenya, this discovery is really shaking up old assumptions about dexterity, strength, and tool use in our ancestors.
It's a really significant find because P. boisei remains were often found near Oldowan stone tools, the earliest undisputed human-like tech.
But without hand fossils, anthropologists couldn't be sure. Was it P. boisei, with its heavy jaws and smaller brain, making the tools?
Or were the tools made by their more modern-looking contemporaries, Homo habilis?
Well, the find revealed this surprising anatomical mix. On one hand, the hands had highly human-like dexterity.
Specific thumb and finger proportions optimized for precision grips. They absolutely had the hardware to make and use stone tools.
Yet, contradicting that modern dexterity, the bones were incredibly robust, much thicker and stronger than ours. Gorilla-like strength.
Suggesting a behavior that combined modern fine motor control with, well, massive ape-like force, maybe for climbing or crushing tough foods.
The big evolutionary implication here is that advanced manual skills, the ability to make precision tools, might have developed much earlier in the hominin line.
Predating the massive brain expansion we see in the Homo genus, the tool-making hardware might have arrived before the specialized software, so to speak.
It definitely complicates the simple story that only Homo was capable of complex manipulation. It helps fill big gaps in our knowledge of Paranthropus.
As the researchers apparently noted, shaking hands with this individual would have felt noticeably different. You'd have been impressed by the raw power.
We are definitely on a roll with anatomical discoveries today. Let's look at the lymphatic system renaissance.
Ah, yes. This system, vessels, nodes, fluid, long seen as, well, a bit dull biologically.
Mostly known as a simple waste disposal and immune system. Collects about 10% of tissue fluid, activates T cells, kind of the plumbing.
But the renaissance was kicked off by those landmark discoveries in 2015 and 2017.
Confirming the existence of a meningeal lymphatic network. MLNs, deep within the brain's dura mater, the outer membrane.
Which completely shattered the decades-old idea that the brain was immune-privileged, physically cut off from the peripheral lymphatic system.
It's a monumental discovery. Huge implications for aging, neurodegenerative disease. Essentially, we found the brain's private waste disposal network.
And researchers found that as we age, these MLNs naturally thin and shorten.
Which drastically slows down the drainage of cerebral fluid. And this poor drainage is now strongly linked to cognitive decline.
Because the MLNs are crucial for clearing out toxic stuff from the brain, right?
Right.
Especially beta amyloid.
Exactly. The specific protein plaque known to build up in Alzheimer's disease. If the waste disposal slows down, the garbage piles up.
The therapeutic potential here seems enormous.
It really does. Boosting MLN drainage, for instance, using a lymphatic growth factor protein called VEGFC in aging mice, partly reversed cognitive decline.
And improved memory in Alzheimer's models, specifically by clearing out that toxic beta amyloid.
What this suggests is maybe lymphatic deterioration isn't just a symptom of neurodegenerative disease. Maybe it's an active trigger.
We're already seeing some incredibly promising, though small, human studies. Surgery to boost drainage in Alzheimer's patients showed slight cognitive gains.
And there might even be non-invasive options. Studies in old mice found specific gentle facial massage techniques boosted brain fluid drainage back up to young mouse levels.
Wow. That points towards potential preventative lifestyle things, maybe.
Could be. And the lymphatic system's potential goes way beyond neurology. It's proving crucial in new cancer approaches, too.
Boosting drainage via MLNs enhanced immunotherapy efficacy against brain tumors.
Yes, specifically anti-PD-1 immunotherapy against glioblastoma in mice. It generated lasting immunity in those studies.
And scientists are also experimenting with artificial lymph nodes, injectable gels.
Right. Engineered to act as temporary T-cell factories. They successfully reduced tumor size in mice with colon cancer and melanoma, basically creating an immune training camp near the tumor.
And taking it even further, using lymph nodes as bioreactors.
To grow mini organ transplants, yeah. Implanting liver, kidney, or pancreas cells into a lymph node near the damaged organ.
The node's rich blood supply helps the cells grow and differentiate, letting the mini organs supplement the failing made of tissue.
It's currently being trialed in humans for end-stage liver disease.
It's just incredible how this previously overlooked system, this biological ghost, could hold keys to treating dementia, cancer, organ failure.
It's truly amazing. Now, moving from the intensely biological to the intensely philosophical, let's tackle consciousness.
Ah, the big one. The core conundrum remains. Consciousness, your subjective inner sense of what it's like, qualia, we still have no consensus on what it is.
Researcher Robert Lawrence Kuhn charted over 350 competing theories. It's a massive philosophical and scientific landscape.
350, that is a lot of disagreement. The theories tend to fall across key philosophical forks, though.
Right. At one extreme, you have dualism, two distinct substances, the mental, maybe a soul or non-physical mind, and the physical, the body and brain.
Foundational to many religious traditions, but most neuroscientists kind of reject it for lacking testable mechanisms.
Then you have monism. Reality is just one fundamental kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Within monism, the dominant scientific view is materialism.
Only the physical is real. Consciousness just emerges from the brain's complex computational activity. That's the working model for most neuroscientists.
Conversely, the monist camp also includes idealism. The mental is fundamental. Physical reality is derived from, or maybe an illusion of, a cosmic mind. Prominent in many Eastern traditions.
And sitting kind of intriguingly between materialism and idealism is panpsychism.
The idea that awareness isn't unique to complex brains, but it's a fundamental property woven into reality itself. Even down at the particle level, consciousness is everywhere, just highly organized in a brain.
And the theory you lean towards really dictates your answers to profound existential questions, doesn't it? Like free will.
Absolutely. Genuine libertarian free will that you truly could have chosen otherwise seems highly unlikely under strict materialist laws. Every effect has a prior physical cause, no room for uncaused choice.
But free will becomes plausible under idealism, which gives mental causation priority, or maybe certain quantum theories that introduce fundamental indeterminacy.
So your own sense of freedom kind of rests on which philosophical camp you fall into.
And what about AI consciousness? AIC.
The framework is just as complex there. For materialists who follow computational functionalism, mind is just complex software on biological hardware. Well, AIC seems inevitable. Just reproduce the function on silicon.
Panpsychists also see AIC as likely. If awareness is everywhere, a complex enough AI structure should harbor some form of consciousness.
Only dualism really prevents AIC, right?
Yeah.
Because a non-physical soul or mental substance can't be technologically replicated or transferred.
And finally, virtual immortality, uploading a specific individual consciousness to survive death.
That scene is even harder, much more remote than creating general AIC. Materialism makes natural survival after death impossible.
Dualism says it's certain. Idealism suggests consciousness might just merge back into the cosmic mind or perhaps reincarnate. Fascinating stuff.
That whole discussion really frames the immense challenge of understanding the self. While we wrestle with that, let's look at a couple of practical topics on societal behavior.
Starting with the real-world effects of school phone bans on mental health.
Right. This policy movement is gaining steam. The Netherlands banned phones in classrooms from Jan 2024. Some schools ban them all day, requiring lockers.
The goal is clear. Cut distractions, maybe curb reported declines in student mental health.
But a new study, looking at two Dutch secondary schools before and after the ban, found the evidence for mental health improvement is, well, inconclusive. Sometimes the opposite happens.
That's right. Researchers saw a slight increase in emotional loneliness post-ban.
That specific feeling of disconnection from close friends outside school, which kids often maintain using their devices during the day.
And even more concerning, socially vulnerable youth kids who already struggled with face-to-face social stuff tended to become more socially lonely after the ban.
They often rely on digital means to manage social interactions, maintain connections. Removing that tool left them more isolated.
It really suggests the phone ban isn't some universal fix. Schools doing this need to watch out for those vulnerable students.
Yeah, the general conclusion of the piece is we just lack robust comparative data. Without better data linking specific bans to long-term outcomes, policy decisions are still pretty difficult.
Okay, now for a more positive behavior finding, something that speaks to our inherent social wiring.
The benefits of group exercise versus going it alone.
An extensive 2023 analysis linked group exercise, especially team sports, to significant mental health benefits. Lower stress, less anxiety, higher self-esteem.
And crucially, these psychological benefits often exceeded those from solo activity, even with the exact same intensity and duration.
So what explains that difference? It seems the social connection itself is a booster.
Both cognitively and physically. Exercising with others creates more accountability. One study found people showed up 35% more often when they had to bring a friend to get a reward.
And there's a biological angle too, apparently.
Yeah, the social connection seems to override the brain's natural protective fatigue signals. A remarkable study showed rowers could exercise 20% longer just by looking at a photo of a loved one compared to a stranger's photo.
Wow. It implies humans are kind of biologically wired to work out together. Maybe linked to ancestral group hunting needs.
That's the thinking. Collaborative, high-effort activities.
Okay, we've covered the global, the personal, the historical. Now let's zoom out to the economic and cultural landscape.
Which this week is really dominated by a topic that feels like a collision of all those individualistic dreams we discussed. The AI bubble.
The warnings are loud, aren't they? Coming from the IMF, Bank of England, major bank CEOs, even OpenAI's Sam Altman.
They're calling it both a financial investment bubble and a public policy bubble.
And the scale of the investment is just staggering, fueled by incredibly exuberant deal-making.
Current estimates. At least $400 billion spent annually just building data centers.
And here's that startling stat from the source. If you remove data center construction from the figures, U.S. GDP growth in the first half of 2025 was barely 0.1%.
Wow. That shows how much apparent economic growth is just tied up in building this one type of infrastructure.
Economic historian Carl Benedict Frey notes this kind of overbuilding is normal in big tech revolutions. Happened with railroads, the dot-com bubble.
But the risk this time is amplified because so much infrastructure is built off-balance sheet.
That off-balance sheet detail is huge.
Yeah.
And dangerous, using complex financing, shell companies maybe, to fund the massive upfront costs.
It completely obscures who actually holds the debt and the ultimate risk.
So if the AI returns don't materialize as promised, the losses could be immense.
And it's unclear if those losses hit just a few tech billionaires or ripple through the whole economy. Could they trigger a banking crisis if high street banks are indirectly exposed?
Economists point to the current profits to valuation ratio for many tech firms as a major red flag, chillingly similar to the dot-com era just before the bust.
But the consensus is also clear. A bust won't mean the end of the tech itself.
Right. Just like railways and fiber optic lines survived previous bubbles, the useful AI tech and the data centers will remain.
The bust will likely mean massive consolidation, fewer players.
Less choice and higher costs for consumers. The experts predict the current free lunch of expansive AI models will end. The true cost will become visible.
Speaking of tech billionaires and their dreams, the culture section has a powerful critique of Silicon Valley's immortality dreams.
The review of the immortalists. It exposes what the author calls engineer's syndrome.
This sort of deep-seated hubristic belief among many tech leaders, often from engineering backgrounds.
That complex biological problems like aging and death can just be solved with an engineering mindset, using the body as a machine to be debugged.
And often ignoring decades of research from actual biogerontologists.
The book highlights a really disturbing cultural anecdote, doesn't it?
Yeah, at an anti-aging festival, a respected scientist tried to temper the hype around her research, warning about safety risks.
And the audience and organizers just dismissed her caution because they wanted the procedure now.
Exactly. Demonstrating this immense, impatient faith in tech over careful science.
But the book argues the real threat isn't biological, it's political.
Right. The immortality quest is often a sideshow to the bigger goal of figures like Musk, Bezos, Thiel, Altman.
Using this agenda to radically rewire the U.S. government in Silicon Valley's image.
Which includes lobbying that might cut funding for vital research helping today's older people, prioritizing futuristic, unproven longevity stuff instead.
On the opposite end of the failure spectrum, there's a review of a documentary, The White House Effect.
Showing how a crucial chance for environmental protection was lost decades ago. It focuses on the 1988 drought, which briefly pushed climate action right to the top in the U.S.
The film shows President George H.W. Bush's initial promise on the environment, campaigning on it.
But then it details this vicious internal White House battle. pro-green advisor Bill Riley versus the powerful climate skeptic chief of staff John H. Sununu.
And that battle ultimately crushed Bush Sr.'s initial climate ambitions. It's a harrowing look at a moment when the world could have acted much earlier.
Shows how political will, even at the top, can be completely neutralized by focused internal opposition.
But there is still hope for collective action, according to another review, The Climate Diplomat by the late Peter Betts.
A legendary UK and EU climate negotiator. His book is an insider's guide to the, quote, labyrinthine world of COP summits.
He details the brutal reality, negotiators spending years strategizing, then weeks locked in windowless rooms.
Forced to thrash out unanimous consensus across mind-boggling issues, dealing with angry leaders or leaders robotically eating biscuits at midnight. It sounds intense.
But his key takeaway from decades of experience, despite the chaos and failures you read about, diplomacy works.
He highlights the crucial measure. Before the Paris Agreement in 2015, the world was on track for over 5 degrees Celsius of warming. Catastrophic.
Less than a decade later, that trajectory has fallen significantly to 2.7 degrees. Still too high, but a massive shift.
Achieved entirely through collective, agonizing diplomatic effort. It's important to remember that.
Okay, as we think about how society might evolve under all these pressures, the magazine includes a fascinating speculation, Future Chronicles, set in 2050.
The idea of replacing conventional prisons with a self-monitoring system called HomeGuard, or Self-Fengsel in Norway.
This speculative system uses advanced monitoring tech for criminals who aren't high flight risks or immediate dangers. Three key parts.
An ankle bracelet with hyper-accurate GPS, a harness with sensors and facial recognition to monitor activity.
And crucially,
a conducted energy device, basically a stun gun built into the ankle bracelet.
Capable of instantly incapacitating the wearer if sophisticated AI detects a breach, like leaving the confined area or doing something illegal.
The speculation suggests successful trials in Scandinavia in the 2030s showed big advantages, drastically cheaper than prisons. And in places like Norway, recidivism rates dropped further, resulting in 95% of prisons closing by 2050 in those trial countries.
And the economic impact was positive, too.
Yeah.
Huge savings from closing prisons.
Reinvested into education and healthcare, leading to lower crime rates overall. It replaces isolation with tech-enforced supervision in the community.
We have truly stand immense ground in this deep dive, haven't we?
From galactic fates and ancestral hands to geoengineering ethics and future prisons. A massive spectrum.
Before we wrap up, we should just briefly mention a few other intriguing bits from the issue.
That spectacular photo of Comet C2025A6 Lemon over Somerset, a once-in-a-millennium sighting. Just reminds you of the vast scale science deals with.
And on personal health, that counterintuitive study on artificial sweeteners. Replacing sugar might actually benefit the gut microbiome.
Yeah, appearing to increase beneficial bacteria that produce short-chain fatty acids. Linked to metabolic health, maybe weight loss maintenance. Needs more research, though.
And finally, busting a stereotype. Why horror fans aren't actually cold and unfeeling.
The study suggests they're not adrenaline junkies or lacking empathy, often score higher on empathy, in fact.
Their motivation is linked more to morbid curiosity, which is associated with better preparedness for real crises and more resilience.
Essentially using horror as a controlled environment to practice emotional regulation. Interesting.
That thread, though, the tension between individual desire and collective systems, that's really what holds this week's issue together, I think.
Yeah. Billionaires trying to bypass global governance, political elites battling over climate, our own minds juggling 350 theories of consciousness.
So let's end with a provocative thought, maybe combining the economic warnings and the philosophical puzzle.
We discussed the strong consensus. The AI bubble looks like it's heading for a financial bust.
But if AI faces a massive financial correction, does that mean the frantic multi-billion-dollar search for artificial intelligence consciousness? The holy grail for many materialists will also slow down.
Or will the hard problem of consciousness, which has haunted thinkers for centuries, just keep driving investment, regardless of market volatility or financial logic?
It makes you consider what societal value beyond just profit or convenience should really be driving the next wave of tech investment.
Especially given the kind of catastrophic global risks we're now seriously contemplating, from geoengineering the atmosphere to polluting low Earth orbit.
That's definitely a complex question for you to mull over as you process this deep dive. Thank you for joining us.
We look forward to delving into the next stack of knowledge with you soon.